All of the food we eat and much of the clothing we wear comes from plants and animals that are raised on farms. Farms are different in type, in size, and even in name.
Welcome to Barn Talk. What happens at the barn stays in the barn, but not today. We're going to let it all out for you guys. Today is going to be a guest episode. Got a guest coming all the way down to Southeast Iowa here to have a great conversation in the barn. But before we get into that, you guys know the drill. If you get any value from the show, share it out with who you know. The more that you guys do that, the more the show grows, the better guests we can get on, the more episodes we can make. Also gives our show a lot of credibility, the more people that listen or watch it. So thank you to all that do that. You can also leave a review on Spotify or Apple. We are over 2,000 five-star reviews on Spotify and over 1,000 on Apple, iTunes. We appreciate you guys for doing that. Continue to do that because that gives our show a lot of credibility. You can also subscribe on YouTube if you want to watch the show. We post shorts there. We post the long-form podcast video version there. It's a great way to consume the show if you don't want to listen. Last thing you can do to support us here at Barn Talk is you can support our direct-to-consumer meat business that we started about a year ago. We sell American Wagyu, pork that we raise here on our farm, pasture-raised chicken. All the farmers that are a part of Farmer Grade show consumers what they do every day on their farm through social media, and it's 100% transparent American-raised meat butchered through American Family Butcher Shops. So if you want to support us there, for the lifetime that this podcast exists, we got a 10% off discount code BARNTALK that you can use to save 10% off on your next order.
That's awful nice of you.
Yeah.
Even the haters can use it. So use the discount. At least if you're going to, you know, if you're going to complain about us, at least get 10% off your meat order. So yeah. If you eat meat.
Maybe yeah, not. Probably not.
Anyway, I digress. So today is a bang up episode because it's very relevant. When we set these guests up, you know, sometimes their story is timeless, and sometimes the timing of their visit is here or there or whatever. But we met these guys a few months ago, and the ag economy is, I guess, it's kind of a mess right now. So our guest today may have some value for people out there trying to navigate what the farming operation is going to look like a year from now, and talk about some of the challenges and probably some tools that are out there that maybe you didn't know about. But he's been in the finance world for a long time, grew up on a dairy farm, and he started a company that a lot of you may not have heard of, but it's really tied into the fabric of agriculture, and they do some really unique things. And he's been around the block a few times, so he knows things. He knows stuff. So without any further ado, let's get into it.
Paul Erickson, welcome to Barn Talk.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. You know, we initially had a call with Paul a few months ago, and we think what you're doing is pretty cool. It's pretty interesting, and we're going to kind of dive in deep today. But before we get going on all the nitty-gritty and that, why don't you give people a little background of who you are and kind of what your journey has been in the world of finance?
Yeah, it certainly didn't start out in the world of finance. Grew up on the Canadian border in Minnesota, last of 10 kids. And my father was 58 years old when I was born, so I believe I was conceived for farm labor at that time. So,
yep.
And you know, led an unsupervised childhood, pretty much as long as I was around to do chores and take care of what I needed to take care of. I was kind of on my own. But, you know, we were talking a little bit before we started about my athletic career, which was related to hockey. It certainly wasn't school. because my high school grades were, well, I'll just leave it at subpar. And my father got cancer first time when I was 14, so I was doing about everything there. And he died when I was 18. And since no university would take me to go and play hockey, I ended up coming to Iowa and playing juniors in Des Moines for the Des Moines Buccaneers. Met my beautiful wife and got trapped.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to make a long story short, took her back up to Minnesota, that in my double wide trailer house. That lasted about 6 months, and she was leaving south with or without me, I think. And so ended up in eastern Iowa working for a farmer, and just decided I need to get an education because $500 a month and all of the beef and pork and milk I could drink was probably not going to cut it when you start having kids. So, yeah, academically, 2-year agribusiness degree from DMAC, worked for a year, went to Iowa State, bachelor's, animal science, started on a master's. Then the second child was born, and so needed to get out and make some money.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of the early background, I guess.
So where'd you go from there then? Did you got out of college, you graduated, you got the education. So what did you do next?
I really wanted to be a pharmaceutical sales rep. Those were the best jobs. That didn't quite work out. So I sold feed for Vigortone. Yep. Eastern Iowa, I was a regional sales manager. We covered all of this area that we're sitting in now. And interestingly, after probably 3 years, I saw a job posting for DuPont in their biotech division. They were posting for somebody to... When I say posting, back then it was a newspaper ad.
Sure.
it wasn't posted.
There was no Indeed back then.
There was no Indeed back then, or LinkedIn or whatever. But for a person to run their ruminant nutrition research, the company was Optimum Quality Grains, if you remember the old Ohio corn.
Yep.
Yeah, grew it all around here. So I worked for DuPont. Ended up becoming the director of business development in U.S. and Canada for 4 years. Went through the JV with Pioneer and was part of the group that acquired Pioneer. Yep. And so, you know, from that standpoint, great education there. You know, didn't really want to enjoy sitting in a cubicle. That's where I was destined. So,
yep.
Went to a Farm Credit of all places, the old AgStar Farm Credit out of Minnesota.
Yep.
Spent 15 years there as on their executive management team, and started Conterra 10 years ago.
So when you joined DuPont, I think I know the answer to this, but so that was kind of out. That isn't like something that you were.
No,
it wasn't in your wheelhouse, but no. you needed a job, and that looked like a good job. But two, you were willing to do whatever you had to do to make it work. And that is like among the people that we talk to. There is something about a farm kid that because you have to do so many things, and half the time, if you don't know what you're doing, you have to figure it out. I mean, that's how we were around here. If we didn't know how to fix something, we either completely broke it in the process of fixing it, or we figured out how to fix it. But when you learn those lessons as a kid, you don't know you're learning a lesson. But when you go to work in a situation like that, you just, like, I feel like people today, if you don't come from that environment,
people want it all laid out for them.
Yeah.
Right. And they don't realize that you figure it out as you go.
100% correct. Even the unsupervised part of my childhood taught me a lot of valuable lessons. Yes. Well, one, how to get into trouble, one, how to get out of trouble.
Yep.
And the trouble wasn't necessarily bad trouble.
Right.
It was, you know, you get stuck, you know, 20 miles from home.
Yep.
You know, how the hell do you get out of it?
Right? Yep.
And so the age of the helicopter parent isn't being very fruitful for our young people these days in terms of using skills, reasoning, all kinds of different skills that you learn at a very young age on the farm.
Yep.
You know, and how to do different things, you know, and trying something and failing. You know, it's all cliche, but the idea that successful people never had a failure is just, I mean, they had a hell of a lot more failures than they have.
Yep.
They've had wins. And, you know, that's at its heart why, I mean, I love being in the ag business and its finance. You hire people that come from that kind of background.
Yep.
That if they see something that needs to be done, they do it.
Yep.
Might have some questions, but that's fine.
Yeah.
But at least they go after it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So you go through the ladder of kind of going through DuPont and then Farm Credit. But you had this vision of Conterra. So tell us a little bit about that vision when you initially were getting out to start this thing and kind of how it got yeah. started.
Yeah, it's an interesting evolution. Whether you're a Farm Credit borrower or you're borrowing from a bank or an insurance company, you know, it's historically in ag, there's kind of been those avenues for finance, whether it's real estate or whether it's operating debt. And, you know, sitting in credit committee at Farm Credit, you know, you spent a lot of time looking at risk ratings, PD ratings, and trying to fit a borrower in a box. And that's the structure they're in. I'm not downgrading it, but as a very heavily regulated institution, and there's reasons for that, why they're regulated, that I started to struggle with seeing transactions that were good borrowers, good farmers. The structure of their debt was not right, too much on the short term and all of that. And I just thought there was a better way to do things. And you want to talk about where luck meets opportunity. How Conterra got its start was really working more as an asset manager for initially Farmer Mac. I was actually at a Twins baseball game with the CEO and the chief credit officer. And they were, Farmer Mac buys a lot of guaranteed, USDA guaranteed loans from primarily banks around the country. And they, the administrator of that guarantee, so a bank sells a guaranteed loan to Farmer Mac, there's an intermediary there that does the collects the payments from the banks who bill and collect, and they essentially shadow account, make sure Farmer Mac's yield is right and payments are the entity that was doing that was in Manhattan. No clue.
No idea.
And they were really looking for somebody, and they asked me if I knew of an entity or somebody that could take over that. So kind of half jokingly, I said, well, tell you what, why don't I start an entity and you give me that portfolio?
Yep.
The old napkin in the bar after is actually how it happened. Made some calls pretty quickly, had the appropriate amount of capital raised, executed the agreements, and away we go.
Off you went.
Yeah. And so really, Conterra was founded and still is very much. We refer to ourselves as an asset manager, billing, collecting loans. Well, to grow the business, we were selling some loans to Farmer Mac. We really didn't have control of the process or the capital.
Yeah, you weren't originating anything. So you were kind of at the mercy of business. You were kind of at the mercy of how much business was being done, because if nobody was initiating a loan, you didn't have anything to...
Yeah, originally that's exactly how it was. But very quickly we said, okay, part of the original business plan, and this is all actually in the business plan, we actually succeeded in every aspect of the original business plan we wrote, except we were about a year late on it.
Well, that's pretty good. Most people can't say that happens that way. So
yeah.
You better get on the horse.
Yeah, right. Your
business plan. Yeah. And we did start originating, and I held a lot of relationships across the United States, because that's what I've been doing for Farm Credit. I started a company for them called Agra Access that was buying loans from banks. So I came from not a dissimilar structure. But what we were able to successfully do is go to New York and sit down with the people that had the money and convince them, educate them first and foremost on agriculture, and then that we knew what we were doing. In ag, the debt providers in ag, whether it's operating or real estate, are very traditional, regulated institutions. It's all held on balance sheet. 95.6% of the ag debt in this country is on a regulated institution's balance sheet. Well, and this came out of when I was working for Farm Credit, it's those good borrowers that didn't fit a risk rating or had an issue, death, divorce, crop loss, you name it, we've seen it. And the theory I had was, boy, you could do essentially what would be called a troubled debt restructure at a bank, solve for liquidity, working capital, had a lot of equity in the real estate, and anywhere from a 1 to 3 year loan, and then move them into conventional financing. Now, this is primarily on real estate debt.
Yep.
And that was wildly successful.
Yep.
You know, so you think about the time frame, which we're not in a dissimilar time frame now, that kind of late 14, 15, 16, 17, those years, you know, we looked at probably in 3 years or less, over $3 billion of applications, loan applications, from farmers. Yep. And then it got really good for a lot of reasons.
Yep.
And now it's the other way.
Yep.
Yeah. So that we've raised and deployed, I should have been prepared with the numbers, but probably around $1 billion in that since 2016.
Yep.
And this is what amazes the institutions, all of the ones that you hear about on the news, the very largest institutions that, depending on what your opinions are of them, the interesting thing is they all want to get into ag. A ton of capital, but they can't. I mean, originating an ag loan and managing an ag loan, especially when all that debt is on somebody else, on a regulated institution's balance sheet. You know, Quintero was really the first one that could do it in any volume to satisfy that. So even though we kind of started out on the asset management side, which is still the core of the business, accounting, reporting, all of those type of things, the origination piece came pretty quickly. One, because of internally what we describe as our rooster funds. That led us down the road to insurance companies.
Yep.
And so now we invest what we call invest for. So we have committed capital from two insurance companies, soon to be four, the way it appears, where we can go toe-to-toe and you know, take a transaction that is all the way from $500,000 to a couple hundred million.
Yeah.
And do that at rates that are below or at what anybody else can do.
Why do you think those kind of companies are wanting to move to ag? Is it because of the stability of land, of the asset class, or what's pushing that? What's driving it?
Probably, you know, there's a whole myriad of reasons or theories that they think about. One that they really don't know until we start talking to them and showing them data is in 10 years, we have taken no losses.
Yep.
Zero.
That looks pretty good to an insurance company.
and especially insurance company, ag debt secured by real estate, farm real estate, the only determinant of capital treatment is the CM rating, which is only defined an ag production ground on loan to value. There's no cash flow test. It's very simplified compared to a bank
corporate
or a farm credit. And so they can apply their capital to a loan that is producing a yield that's better than they can get on about any other CM1 and have the lowest capital treatment, right?
Low risk.
Low risk, higher return. And so that's one thing. You know, the thing you hear in the news, growing populations, you know, food, all of those type, you know, they're not making any more land.
Yep.
All of those things. And without a doubt, the United States is the best place in the world to grow food.
Yep.
Right? Best transportation systems. And a lot less riskier place than other parts of the world. And they see that population dynamics. They look at this, well, how do we get involved in ag? Problem is nobody wants to sell ag debt.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, one of the questions that we have on our list is we wanted to talk about the land market. And, mm-hmm. you know, the real simple truth is it's a scarcity deal. Mm-hmm. You got a lot of people that want to buy land. Yeah. And in our little world, we look at it as, you know, we know every piece of ground that is going to go for sale or might go for sale, or because you go down the road and you know how old this guy is and whether they've got any kids and all that. But at the end of the day, county by county, state by state, not very much of that land moves at any one time. And so as a result, everybody wants to know, you know, are we in a bubble? Is this the new normal? What's the trend? We're in scarcity. Plus, exactly what you talked about, when you look at the world of assets and land being scarce and a lot of uncertainty in a lot of other assets, I don't think land values are going anywhere but up.
Yeah, what are your thoughts on that? What do you think about land values? Do you think it's here to stay? Do you think there's a bubble? What do you think?
Well, depends on what you mean by bubble. But just a little bit of background and to close kind of the Quintera thing is we're unique from the standpoint that 90% of what we do is high quality, low rate business with the nation's farmers across the United States. The other part is on the more of the rooster, the troubled debt stuff, is we have the flexibility of capital to take situations that no regulated lender's gonna do, and we fix them. Mm-hmm. And so how that relates to land values, right? So we spend a lot of time on land, but land that's and values that are in a troubled debt situation tend to really sell at discounted rates, especially if it's a fire sale, and you got a lot of issues that come with that. Versus George down the road is going to sell a quarter, and it's really good land, and you'll have all of the neighbors in there mm-hmm. wanting to get a piece of that. So I said earlier, this kind of reminds me of 2016-17 range. During that time, we like in use the Midwest here, you had corn price that probably, I think it hit its high in 14, if I remember, by a little over $7 yep. a bushel, and then came off pretty hard. Land values, depending, the first thing we saw was really good land held its value or declined less than poor land. Makes sense.
Yep.
Okay. But on the average, we saw from kind of peak to trough, 15 to 20% declines in real estate values, depending on what part of the country you were mm-hmm. in. And you can look at all kinds of charts that give you that story. It wasn't long after that trough where you were back mm-hmm. At record highs.
Yeah, it was very quick.
Happens very quick. And an important part of that, depending on your, the opinion of this is differing, differs depending on who I talk to. In the institutional land buyers, when I say institutions, it's the big ones. It's you know, where they've raised primarily pension money to invest in land, you know, famous, or it's a large family office, you know, Bill Gates as an example. Okay. I spoke at a conference in New York called Global Ag Investing. And it happens every year, and it gets all of these institutions from around the world in, and they took an informal poll, and there was more money stacked up to buy farm ground in that room than there was farm ground for sale in the United States. Mm-hmm. So again, the thesis, scarcity, population growth, all of those type of things. Well, so in the last, since then, in the last 7 years, they've been in the market in a big way. We finance probably 8 of the largest ones. But what's been happening in the last, especially in permanent plantings, almonds, pistachios, tree nut, you know, citrus, they haven't been in the market for 2 years. Very little has gone to institutions. And we're seeing now, take California. We do a lot of business in California, and you have the added complexity there of water as well. So poor land, poor water, which was at one time when almonds were $4, everything in the country was getting planted to almonds.
Yep.
Stuff that should never have been planted. But we've seen some tracts sell at, they're down 50% from what the appraised value was, you know, 2 years ago. But you see the same scenario. Good water, good land, holding its value on the other side.
Yeah.
So when you talk, I think there's bubbles. If you, I don't necessarily like that term. There's so many variations by state, by geography, that, you know, I guarantee you around here or north central Iowa, it might come off a little bit, or the highs may be lower, but I don't.
I think it's really in Midwest, it is totally, it's practically county by county dependent. It's, hell, it's almost township dependent because, you know, it, like in our area, there's enough interested parties that a piece of ground that comes up for sale, it's definitely not going to dip. Now, if you go one county south or one county south and east, it may be a different story because there again, the quality is not quite as good and the number of interested parties may not be as many,
the data that, and it's hard to actually piece this together, but, you know, what I've heard in Iowa is 70-80% of the farm ground has no debt on it.
Right.
And the staying power of a farmer without a big debt load, you know, they can ride through some stuff. But if you're levered 60-70% on everything you got, that's what we're starting to see now. We're seeing now farms that really didn't do what they needed to do when times were good.
Yep.
are getting not spanked. Faring. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's on their sheet actually. So you know, it's a difficult time right now for farmers and in agriculture. You know, what are some key numbers or ratios that you know farmers should be looking at, should be watching, to kind of help them weather the storm or prepare for the next storm to come?
Well, you know, there's a whole host of things that we look at in the underwriting side of it. You know, certainly whether it's a non-ag business or an ag business or a farm, working capital, liquidity is key. Yep. If you don't have that in tough times, it makes it hard to get through it, right? So, yep. You know, we look at a total debt coverage. A minimum standard would be 1.25 to 1. So when you look across our portfolios, because there's several of them, probably the weighted average is about 1.6. On the more the alternative side, the rooster stuff, it's less because they've had some issues, but we're solving for that. So working capital to OpEx is another ratio. At a minimum, we want to see like 115, so 15% margin. We'd like to see more than that, but that's kind of a minimum. So what floors me about our farmers, nation's farm, not all of them, and I don't want to, because I know some ones that are really good at financial management, record keeping. You know, it is inexcusable for a farmer to walk in to a banker and not know their financial position. Yep. So, I mean, balance sheets, you know, simple income statement, you know, there's a lot of ways. We're not, nor do we expect farmers to have audited financial statements. Yep. But you just have to, and, you know where you're at, be able to produce your financial statements. Mm-hmm. And when you walk into a banker, it's going to give you at least two things. It's going to tell that banker, okay, these guys know where they're at. And it's probably even going to get you a lower rate.
Yep.
And, but I just see way too much crap.
Well, I think some of that's a generation. I don't know. I feel like some of that's a generational deal. You're 100% right. And you know, full disclosure, I'm a customer of the Farm Credit System. Mm-hmm. Farm Credit down in this area, they decided in the late 90s that financing hog confinements was a good idea.
Yep.
And thus they did a hell of a bit. They continue to. It doesn't work quite as well as it used to. But so, you know, when we were starting out, their ability to give you a long-term rate, mm-hmm. that made a lot of difference for guys when you could lock that rate in. You know, we started these things, we could cash flow them on 7 years, then we went to 10 years, then it's 12 years, and then it's 15 years, and I don't know what guys are doing now. I pity anybody that would finance a hog building for 20 years, but I know that that's probably out there because the cost has gotten so far out of hand. But I had a pretty candid conversation with a banker not very long ago, and I just asked him what percentage of people can do that walk in there and have their balance sheet and their financial statement and can do a cash flow or have a cash flow. Mm-hmm. And he said that to this day, he said that a majority of his customers count on them to put together a balance sheet and a cash flow for them. And that just floors me, because the one thing that I don't think guys even, they don't even think about is, at that point, you literally have no, you have no bargaining power, because that guy, and I'm not saying that any banker has the mentality that they've got like right. their thumb on you, but they know you're not going anywhere else. They know you're not going to shop around, because if you can't get your, like, if you don't know where you're at and you're asking right. them to put together your financials, they know pretty much that you're going to do exactly what they tell you to do. And you have to realize that what is best for the bank or for that particular bank may or may not be what is the best for your farming operation. And I don't think people understand that there are times where it's good to have options. And if you aren't in charge of your finances, if you can't, if you don't know where you're at, you're not going to have any options. So that's my two cents.
Yeah, I agree. I'm preaching to the choir. I'm sure Paul agrees too.
I could tell you guys so many stories, because when times are good,
nobody cares.
Floats. When the shit hits a fan, you want to talk about bankers having your thumb on you. I've got a couple of situations on very large credits right now that we're trying to work through, and they're just trying to figure out how to get out.
Yeah.
The bank, right?
Yeah.
And so at a minimum, if somebody's in the family is an accountant and knows how to do this well, by all means, use that resource. If they're not, there's all kinds of bookkeepers.
Yep.
Okay. And, you know, I'm not a big social media person.
Yep.
Generally, it's the scourge of the earth, but
yep. But there's exceptions.
There are exceptions.
Barn Talk being one.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. But on LinkedIn, some very specific farm people, in this case, yep. I know two ladies that their husband farms and they're holding out a shingle as a bookkeeper. Get your stuff on QuickBooks. You can have at the touch of your mm-hmm. finger,
yeah.
your reports and all of that. I can guarantee you that if you have a Main Street business or just a commercial lender going in to lend on a small manufacturing business, I can guarantee you they have their widget accounting done.
Yeah.
Right. And ag has never had, well, the idea that it, just to contrast commercial, you know, Main Street business with farm, there was capital up and down the credit and the rate spectrum for that Main Street business. There's never been that for ag, period. And where that commercial business had to have its act together in terms of its financial reporting and understanding, ag, I mean, quite frankly, a lot of the bankers, as he said, do the balance sheets, do, mm-hmm. you know, and it's at a point where, as we head into this down cycle, it's going to get really bloody in places. And you just have to be able to know that your financial metrics and if for no other reason than make a decision not to do something or to do something, or I mean,
never hurts to know where you're at.
Something that I'm just, this is just out of curiosity, when, and I don't know if there's numbers on this or not, but this is near and dear to my heart because I am right in the middle of it. And actually, a neighbor of mine that we go back and forth with a lot, he's in the exact same situation. So we would fit that demographic of very low debt on land, but very poor cash flow. And the reason for that is healthcare. Because my father passed away about 5 years ago, and my mother is in a retirement home. Mm-hmm. And she's been there 5 years. And when she entered that home, those bills had an 8 in front of them. Today, they're almost 11 in 5 years.
Yeah.
And 5 years ago, cash flow on the farm compared to what I'm looking at for crop year 24, not as good. So you have health care cost going up. You have farm revenue hopefully flat, hopefully not coming down right. too far. But as I talk to people around the country, the amount of operations that have some kind of a situation like that, and that's tough. That is really tough because it's really hard to, you don't know how long that's going to last. Right. And you hate to, you know, we have this conversation around here. You feel guilty having that conversation right. about, you know, how long is this going to go on? But the reality is that somehow you have to deal with it. And the amount of equity being eaten up in this country, not just from ag businesses, but from just mom and pop businesses that are generational. I don't know what that number is, but it's got to be huge.
Yeah. You know, you talk about healthcare, and we have less than 50 employees, you know, 45-ish roughly.
Yep.
And you look at what our healthcare costs are, and in running this business,
yep.
They went up another 12% this year. Now, we choose to very much offset that cost for our employees.
Yep.
But not everybody can do that.
Yeah, right? Exactly right.
And so when you look at the amount of equity being eaten up in any business in America, especially a farm, you know, there's a lot of reasons, right? There's inflation on everything, healthcare, just on your inputs, on, you know, and so to take it back to the kind of the financial side, if farmers, ranchers took as much care in their, as they do in their breeding plans for their beef herd or in their planning plans for in hybrid selection, all of those type of things, if they took as much care in their financial reporting and understanding as they do in that. And of course, it's one thing, you get the information, but then you got to make a decision about mm-hmm. it. And it's, I mean, we've actually had clients that were on the way to file bankruptcy and stopped by and traded a combine. I mean, who does that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, just that, and you know, I come from a farm where my father did not have a clue, I think, where he was at in any detail. He knew how much money he owed, guarantee you that. And, but there was no business financial acumen there. And I see it, you said it was maybe generational. I think in part it is. I mean, you know, a young person going to college or not going to college or going to a trade school or going to, you know, to at least or have mentors, you know, mm-hmm. parents or grandparents that speak that language is really important in terms of running a business and all the aspects that go with it. And but the costs are just out of this world.
Yeah, it's crazy. I just feel like ag's at a point, being a farmer at this point, like back in the day you always talk about how grandpa, he'd be like, well, how many pigs have we got to sell this week to pay the bills? Yep. You know, it was just like, well, we got to sell this many pigs to keep her going.
Yep.
Now you can't afford it. It's too competitive.
Got to take a load of grain to town.
Yeah. It's too competitive now.
Grandma,
you cannot
needs a
do
new
it.
Washing machine.
Yeah. And that's 100% true too. I mean, there were part of that is generational in the fact that that's a true story. I was born in 71 and they had just finished, my parents moved to the house that I live in now and they had redone it. And I asked my dad, I remember asking my dad about this, when my wife and I redid the house that my parents lived in, they called that the honeymoon house, the house that Sawyer lives in now. They live there.
He needs to go to it. So he's going to be in the honeymoon.
And he will be.
I will be. Yep. Hey, let's face it. It's a honeymoon every day.
Every day.
Every day in there.
Yep. But I asked him, I said, when you redid that, I said, did you go borrow the money for that? And he said, oh, God, no. God, no. And I told the carpenter that I would pay him every month. And I was farrowing over there in the 20 pen. He had 2 20 pen farrowing houses, and then he had 20 pens in this barn. And then he finished the pigs out on alfalfa, and he had it all plotted off. And he said, I had it to where I had a group of hogs to sell every month. And so Gander would bring me the bill, and then I'd figure out how many pigs we needed to load up. And I'd call Nup, and they'd bring the straight truck. And then we'd take him to Oscar Mayer, and then I'd write him a check.
There you go.
And I was like, God, I wish it still worked that way. But, you know, it was a whole – and that was the generation, though, that was the generation that it was – everything to create an asset involved manual labor. Mm-hmm. So if you could work hard enough, how much money you needed was based – or how much money you could make was based on – basically how many hours a day you wanted to work. So if you just outworked everybody, right, and that was their mentality, was you just need to work more. And today the return on physical labor versus mental labor, it's a different dynamic. But just there's some things you can work as hard as you want, and when the medical bill piles up, you know, it
numbers got to work.
The numbers, no matter how late you stay up,
they gotta work.
Yeah, they gotta work.
Yeah, so they do, and I agree with you. But now, for this a person that really wants to work and gets out, gets on it, they can still make things work. You know, it's understanding. You know, your parents, my parents, they lived within their means, mm-hmm. and they were, you want to talk about working. I mean, these, and I hate to pick on the kids. I say the kids these days, it sounds like
it's fine. We do it all the time.
Sound like my father, you know, but I don't think most of them, a lot of them, I shouldn't say most of them, a lot of them don't know how to work. And my father was born in 1906. And so you think about what that man lived through, the Depression, all of those time frames. And I tell you, the guy knew how to work and expected his sons and daughters to know how to work as well.
As a society, our level of what is a need is significantly higher than what past generations were. And this is a true story. When I was in grade school, like, I don't know if I was in third or fourth grade, somewhere in there, one day our teacher in our homeroom asked us, go around the room, and she wanted everybody to say one thing they liked or one reason why they liked coming to school. And I was really anxious about that because I couldn't think of one reason why I wanted to be at school. I think I probably said something like recess.
Right.
And this girl, Amy, that was in my class, when it came to her, she said, I love coming to school because it's warm. Because her dad was a tight ass and always kept the house as cold as what anybody could stand it.
Yeah, so it was that because I didn't have to work for 10 hours a day. I could get some time off.
Yeah, you know, exactly. So it's different. And we've prospered. As a nation, we've prospered. But also the expectations, and that's one of the things that I think is – I feel for the generation that's just getting started right now, trying to start a family, trying to get a house, trying to get going, because on one hand, it's expensive and interest rates are not your friend. But on the other hand, the standard is what you expect that you are going to be able to have starting out based on your upbringing it's so much higher. Like what we take for granted is just, it's a lot, I feel like. And it's a lot for another generation to think that they're going to be able to just come out of the gate and have that. But we get off a little bit.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on interest rates, long-term interest rates? What do you think? What's your outlook on it? And what does it mean for farmers?
Get my crystal ball.
Yeah, grab that.
You should get a magic eight ball to have up here. Just to
shake it up.
I remember those. Well, I'll talk first about maybe the market psychology and where, from talking to a lot of farmers, what they thought was going to happen and what they were anticipating happening. Well, first to answer your question, it's an election year, right? So I don't think anything's going to run away. Yep. Are rates going to go lower? Maybe. So we tend to look a lot at the 10-year treasury as kind of a base for what we're doing. We index a lot along, do a 10-year fixed rate, even though we can go out to a 30-year, straight up 30-year fixed rate. No one wants a 30-year fixed rate in this environment.
Yep.
But so the 10-year treasury right now at 4.40, could it get to 4? Yes. Could it get to 3.50? Probably unlikely. Mm-hmm. On the inverse of that, 5, see that.
Mm-hmm.
5.50, maybe. So in the world has a habit of going contrarian to the events that take place and all the stuff that's going on today in this world. I would put a lot of money on this, that we are never going to be back at what, at a treasury.
The '80s rates.
We're never going to be back on the high end at the '80s, but we're not going to be back to the 50 basis point treasury. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And as we looked at coming out of those, the lowest rate that I put out, I believe it was a 7-year fixed, was 2.7%.
Yep.
You don't think that'll ever come back?
No.
Why do you think that?
Well, I think the it has a lot to do with the condition of the world economically, and the fact that the U.S., when given a chance, is pretty darn resilient, and it amazes me how much money people still have. And you start back at a, I think the worst thing for the long term for this economy would be to go back to those rates. What it spurs on in terms of inflation, and variability of rates. Someone has to show me, I'm not saying it can't happen, but someone has to show me what event or series of events are going to happen that causes the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, or any other group around the net to have to reduce interest rates to that point ever again. I think COVID was a crock.
Yeah, we agree.
And some of the things we did.
And hopefully we learned some things from that. Although I don't know, but
the number one issue with today is generally this population forgot what we learned 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Short-term memory.
Short-term memory and making some of the same mistakes. My guess is I'll be dead long time before interest rates ever get back to there again.
Yeah. So, that said, if you're a farmer out there and you are trying to figure out how you're going to keep operating, and let's face it, you know, just like the situation here, you've got another generation that you're trying to get into that farm, and the economics tell you that you're going to have to farm a little more than what you're farming now to keep the same level of income. So when you're looking at that and you're trying to figure out how you can make a land purchase work, what do people have for options? What can you do if you're looking down the barrel of, I want to pull the trigger and buy this, but I'm not sure. And I'm not saying from a trouble position, even from if you're in a sure, decent position, but you're not, I guess you're not flush.
Right. But there's going to come a time, and you know, that time is today for a lot of people, to where they see a piece of ground come up and they're trying to do exactly what you say they're going to do. You know, if you're levered up to 50, 60%,
yep,
There's not too many that are going to come in and borrow that. If you need to borrow that, no. Because that means you're if you're levered at that, you've already levered your real estate, right? But what we're seeing and what we do routinely is even if we have to take another lender out, so refinance that you got a farm with a bunch of equity.
Yep.
Right? So, you know, you want to buy this farm coming up, you're just going to have to use the equity from your existing to provide a loan that a bank will do.
Yep.
So I can tell you 50 LTV loans, sub 50 gets you the best pricing. You know, and right now I know you're a farm credit borrower and that's great. I mean, I like farm credit, right? There's nothing, but their cost of funds and what they need to do today to sell a farm credit bond is their rates aren't that attractive.
Yep.
You know, I can get in the mid sixes right now pretty easily.
Yeah.
And we're in general much more competitive than a farm credit. And we have probably more flexibility around how to structure some of those deals.
Sure.
So when you look at ways to put that deal together, there is no magic bullet, right? It is you underwrite it. Where's your collateral value? How does cash flow look? The thing that we're starting to do, a lot more, we have kind of a unique, and it's not necessarily unique, but farm credits don't typically use this, or other insurance companies, but if you've got a lot of equity in your real estate and you're not looking for a real estate loan, but you're looking for a low-cost operating line, we'll do 5-year revolving lines of credit secured by the real estate, and you draw and pay back as you needed, no annual renewal, and you have that liquidity there if you need it.
Yep.
Or want it. Generally, operating rates today are, let's call it 775 to 9.5.
I'd say if you can find somebody, at least from what I know around here, if it's got a 7 in front of it, you should feel pretty good, because a lot of them are 8. A lot of them are 8 or better.
And we can get substantially under that with that real estate secured revolving line of credit. Now, I understand, you know, sometimes farmers don't want to lever their land.
Yep.
But if you're saving a couple points.
Well, and here's the other.
You know, that's kind of the trait. You got to make trade-offs. You got to look at economically how things work.
Here's the other thing, and I think farmers are forever optimists, and I'm one of them. My wife will tell you that to a fault, because she a lot of times is the voice of reason, and I'm maybe sometimes I have unrealistic optimism.
We all have that. Just keep that in mind, Sawyer.
Yep. If you're in a situation where your cash flow or your operation isn't working today, you need to be proactive, because a lot of people, I hear a lot of people saying they don't like these rates. Like, they don't like these rates. Guys don't want to have to refinance something. They don't want to have to use that equity. They don't want to have to do anything, because I've got this real estate loan and I've got it locked in, and it's 4.75% or it's 4%, but I've got cash flow problems.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just had this conversation with a guy 3 days ago. That 7 or that 8, that doesn't sound that great, but if you stick your head in the sand and you wait till next year, and then that number's got a 10 on it, boy, you're going to think, you're going to look at that interest number and you're like, man, I wish I would have done something when I could have gotten a 7 in front of it. And that, you have to have perspective as far as, and I think a lot of people have fond memories of what we were talking about, of those ultra low interest rates. And believe me, I sold, the company I used to work for, we sold thousands, literally thousands of hog buildings. Right. And that low interest rate was the best thing that ever happened to our business.
True.
I mean, that was like handing out candy, because those things cash flowed so well at those low interest rates.
And it to give you an example of that, we added about close to $1 billion of assets in 2021.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of activity that was happening at those rates was amazing.
Yeah. Right. So, anyway, you know, when we talk about these, we're not where we used to be, but you still, if you have a problem, dealing with it sooner than later is a lot better outcome.
Yeah. And so what we saw when Treasury started popping up from, you know, 50 basis points and went to 350, 400. Yeah. And then, so everybody understands, you take the Treasury, you put your lending margin on top of that, and that's the borrower rate. And a really low rate would be, say, 200 over like Treasuries.
Yep.
There's some stuff that goes off a little less than that. So, you know, at Treasuries at 5, you know, the best maybe you can hope for is 7. But historically, you look at that and say, where were rates? Now, people like to bring that out, but costs and expenses were also different in those time frames. But we couldn't get anybody to take a 20, 30-year fixed rate when that had a 4 in front of it. They're not taking it when there's a 8 or 9 in front of it. But on a 10-year, if you could get something with a 7, because what they were doing then, instead of taking those longer term fixes, they were doing 3 and 5 year maturities. So we actually have a system that we can look and see all the mortgages around the United States, kind of what their rates are at. There's a ton of 3 and 5 year maturities coming up.
Yep.
And a lot of, and they were also going variable rates, straight monthly variable. And on the way down, that was a great play, yep. Right?
Yep.
But there comes a point in time where it's yeah. not. And we're at that.
Yeah. 100%.
Yep.
Yeah. So do you have any other hot takes or some things that are on your mind on the just, it can be financial in general, economy, or ag lending or ag finance that you want to talk about that we didn't cover that you're kind of like wanting to talk about?
Yeah, I've had some people that shall remain nameless were after me to watch what I say.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I watch some of your stuff on Barn Talk, and I forget what's the hot topic.
Yeah,
yep.
Hot topics.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Those are my favorite.
Sometimes.
Those are my favorite ones.
Sometimes yeah. they get a little
spicy, a little hot.
A little spicy.
A few F-bombs here and there.
You know, and this is the idea, you know, a lot of things happening in the world. A lot of opinions on both sides of the aisle, and what gets portrayed is it's either this or it's this, mm-hmm. right? When we think that the vast majority of Americans can kind of see both sides of, yeah. of things and have a reasonable discussion. But that's not what gets portrayed in the media. And whether that's immigration is our immigration policy is horrible in so many different ways. But whether it's H-2A or whatever, it's America, and especially ag.
Yes, 100%.
You know, whether it's milking cows or doing whatever, relies on immigration.
Yep.
And so, you know, I really wish we could get that figured out.
Yep.
Both from a safety and security standpoint, as well as just what it takes to run this country. A good friend of mine you had on here, Mike Nagg.
Yeah.
And you know, he ranks as the only political donation I've ever made in my life. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I know he has some thoughts on immigration and what it means to ag. So that's one thing. I don't know how we figure that out.
Yeah. I think one of the, if you talk to anybody that is involved in a business that needs labor, mm-hmm. immigration is what they're relying on, because we do not have enough people for the labor that needs to be done, especially in ag. And what really frustrated me when I went to work for the production side,
right.
The vast majority of our pig production, as far as on the sow unit side, is from TN Visa. Mm-hmm. And it does not need to be, my take on it is that there are an awful lot of really good people that want to come here and want to become citizens, mm-hmm. and our government should streamline that. Mm-hmm. The problem that we have, and I think this is the problem we have with so many issues, is when one side has the ball, the other side doesn't really want them to get the credit for fixing it. So they'll stonewall it, and then they'll fundraise on why it's not getting done. And then when it flops and they have the ball, the other side, they're butthurt because they couldn't do it. And we end up having in our two-party system, which I don't know, it's what we've got, so it's what we've got to deal with. But both sides spend so much time fundraising to get either back in power or stay in power. We spend a lot of money not fixing things. And immigration to me is it's something that we can all agree on that it needs to be fixed. And I just don't understand why we don't have the political fortitude to do it.
Yeah, the vast majority of our politicians on both sides of the aisle do not have a realistic understanding of what goes on in America. Yep. They're in their little bubble. They're arguing about stuff that makes no sense. And so at the end of the day, I mean, I don't even watch the news anymore. I turn on RFD TV in my office. I'll skim a few other channels, but when I can't, it gets me so worked up that I'm like, you know, so the political environment's an issue. I know, you know, and this is not just going to be for agriculture, and I'm not a doomsdayer here by any means, but, you know, the Main Street America, these politicians, you know, they just don't understand that for normal, everyday people, the cost of living is outrageous.
Yeah, 100% right? It is.
And they just don't seem to get that. I just hope one day the electorate would come together and say, okay, you guys are idiots. And
yeah, and then on the other side of it, I don't fault you. Like when I think about we wonder why we got here, but then at the same time, who in their right mind would want to be a politician?
Like, don't know.
Who would want to put themselves through that?
Have no clue.
We complain about these guys and these women and how they're complete narcissists. Well, you'd have to be a complete narcissist, because the only person that's going to tell you that you're a good person is the person looking in the mirror.
My solution is pay each one of our congressmen $400,000 a year.
Yep.
Ban them from any sort of stock trading and put 2-year term limits on it.
Yep.
And pay them well enough to attract somebody for a couple of years, and they're done.
Yeah.
And
serve their country.
Exactly.
Then they leave, like it used to be.
Yep, I could get behind that real easy.
Well, I guess I don't want to dive into that too much. So, because I know you got to be on your tippy toes walking on that. But let's talk about hunting, cattle, hockey, rodeo, or whiskey. We got a few of your hobbies here that I know you like to dabble into. So
yeah, well, the first thing I want to ask you about that is, so now you have come far enough, you got a little bit of perspective.
Yeah.
So do you think that you would be further ahead if you could go back, if you would have just tried a little harder at hockey? Do you think that you'd be chewing your food, or you think you'd have, I mean, how do you think? You think you're better off for not pursuing that harder, or?
My life would have been different.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a variety of ways, probably. I was never, I don't want to make you think that I was this world's best hockey prep player.
Right.
Played in Europe. Played some, you know, so yep. I come from a town that it's nothing but hockey, yep. Right? But I was never good enough to make it to the NHL. I could have played pro hockey at a lower level,
yeah.
But I'd had enough riding buses and all of that, so...
Well, we're pretty uneducated about it down here.
Yeah.
But my question is, do you keep up on it? Are you still a fan?
To some degree. I used to be a lot more of a fan as I knew a lot of players.
Yep.
In the NHL. I had many people from my hometown were either Olympians, they were on the 1980 Olympic hockey team. Yep. You know, they, and other Olympic years. And so I'd followed it more, but all of my kids were baseball, football.
Sure.
So I kind of got into the baseball and football, but you know, hockey was, it got me out. I'd never, if it wasn't for hockey,
never made it off the farm.
I would have never made it off the farm.
Yep.
And, you know, I went to a little country school. I think I had 9 people in my class. And that get aggregated at 7th grade. And you in that 6 miles south of the Canadian border, it was you're playing hockey or hunting.
Yep.
At least that was mine. My scenario, I wasn't doing much. Well, I was doing some other things I shouldn't have been doing.
Yes, right.
But that's
right.
That's a whole nother story. But no, you know, team roped for a long time. You know, but when you get married and have kids, yep. Sawyer, you know, some of these hobbies need to change, and it comes back to the mentality that okay, I've got new responsibilities. Put my head down, make things work in a certain way.
Right? Yep.
And, you know, it's nothing, you know, I've had a lot of different experiences in my life, probably more than most in terms of what I've done and what I've actually failed to do. So.
Do you still make it out to hunt much? What's your...
More now.
More now.
More now, as I've got a really good team of people. People think I'm retiring, but I'm not. But I have hired my successor.
Good.
Who's the president, who will be the CEO next year. His name is Jake Espenmiller. Many listening will understand that name. And so I'm going to work more of the risk asset side, do investor stuff, but it gives me more time for hunting. So, you know, I've shot enough whitetail in my day that now I like going out to Wyoming and shooting elk and mule deer and antelope.
What are you using? What's your cartridge when you're going out at that distance?
300 Win Mag.
Okay.
I bought a Christensen Arms, one for my first elk hunt in New Mexico.
Yep.
And it is a Gillen machine. I just bought a suppressor for it.
Nice.
Got approved in a day and a half.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
That's not very typical.
So is that, well, I don't know.
No, the people are waiting 7 to 9 months.
How'd you manage to do that?
Did you?
Well, it's I'm such an upstanding guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that was it.
Know a guy that knows a guy.
What I was told is the ATF has got hearings at Congress. And one of the things on the agenda is why the long waiting periods. And so the people that applied a month ago are still on a track for 7 to 9 months. The people that have applied within the last months, they're turning them in a day or 3 days, day to 3 days to get the average wait time down.
So instead of, they're working at the top of the pile because that's the
they're
fastest.
Trying to change those
the
numbers.
Averages.
So apply for a suppressor is what you're saying.
Well, yeah. Heck,
you get it in a heartbeat.
We better cut this short.
Yeah, we got some shopping to do.
I mean, not that we have any guns to put them on, right?
Yeah, right.
But
if
we did have, we should go probably get that ball rolling.
Yep. That's right.
But that 300 Win Mag is so loud. It's got a ported barrel at the end. And when I'm at the range, fine, hearing protection. But if I happen to be walking along and an elk jumps up or a mule deer, I'm like, the last thing I'm thinking about is putting it in. And you pay for it. My left ear, it's a day.
No
kidding.
To get
that back into shape. But I'll shoot a lot with that. Just practice, you know, comfortable really 400, 500, 600 yards.
Yep.
Outside of that, I've never shot. So I love doing that. But before I leave, we're going to pick up some firmer grade meats.
Heck yes.
Heck yes.
Yes, sir.
I'm a meat guy, so I process all of my own and I'll make sausages, you know, deer and elk and kids.
You're just checking all the boxes. And he even showed up and brought us a bottle of whiskey. So,
I know, right?
I don't know.
He's kicking every other guy's
ass. I think
we
probably should put together a checklist.
There could be a man crush going on.
Yeah. Something like that. Something like that.
I do need to do a little bit of shout out for the Utica King.
Tell us that story.
Doug Morgan, investment banking attorney. Good guy. He's more of a friend of my partner's. I'll call him a close acquaintance of mine. He owns this company called Mount Vernon Barn Company. He dismantles old barns, repurposes
the wood.
Just sets them back up and cool stuff. Well, in this little town of Utica, Ohio, he bought an old mill, a distillery, and it's the old copper kettle, big copper kettle still.
Yep.
And he's this is supposed to be a Pappy Van Winkle lookalike, but tastes like it's good.
Yeah.
I can't believe
it. What's his name of his distillery?
Mill Street.
Mill Stream.
Yep. Mill Street. So
Mill Street. Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised I don't have a drink in my hand right now, but that's another subject.
Well, we
would have started a little bit later. Maybe we would have taken it out.
I didn't know the dynamics of the handlers that you brought. I didn't know if somebody was going to slap my hand if I put a glass. So we were taking it easy.
We were taking all the precautions.
But believe me, this is a fully functioning. This is a fully stocked barn, and one thing that we don't have here is a clock, and that is by purpose.
It's because
when the conversations start,
I want you to get lost in it.
It takes as long as it takes.
Get lost in the conversation and the whiskey.
No, on the other topics, I mean, we've hit a lot of good things. The secret to whatever success I've had is because it's not because I'm the smartest SOB in the world. I'm not. It's recognizing an opportunity and finding really good people to help you to do that. And that's one thing. The average tenure at Conterra is, I mean, many of them were with us at the start, including the ones in the room today. Just good people that approach business with some humility, which is important. People sometimes will look at me and say, well, he's the last one that should talk about humility. But in reality, that's how you need to approach business and understand your client and really try to do what's best for them, right?
Yeah.
You don't get anywhere the other way. So
yeah, correct.
Good people, understanding of the business, putting your head down. I mean, starting a business, you guys know this. I saw this representation one time. It was an upside down bell curve, what it looked to me. And in the upper left, it's all the euphoria around starting a business. Oh, yeah. I'm going to do this. And then you go a little bit further down. It says, well, this is a little tougher than
what I thought.
Yep.
Then you get to the bottom of it and says, this absolutely sucks.
Yep.
I don't want to do this. And then it starts getting a little better. And then you come up the other side. But it's always a challenge to market dynamics and a whole lot of things.
Yep.
Especially for us. It's we're not capitalized as a lender. We're essentially using someone else's balance sheet. Now, those are some very large balance sheets that commit capital. It's committed capital. But there's nothing to say 3 years from now that X lender.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, one that we were investing for got acquired. So they've been shut down for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And so it's those type of things that come into play. So you always got to be
looking out.
Yep.
And trying to manage a business in that way. And, farmers are kind of approach lending in the same way they do their favorite equipment or their favorite breed of livestock, and this is what I'm gonna go with. That's great, right? One of the things we've seen as operations have gotten bigger, it becomes more and more important to diversify their debt sources. I've got a situation now where it's a deal I'm working on, but the operating lender has both sides of this thing, and they're putting a squeeze, and there's about $260 million worth of debt that I'm trying to restructure, which they really wouldn't have been in that situation if they would have had a little diversity in that. And people really need to think of that.
It's good to have options. It's good to have options, and it's good to know your options.
Yep.
So if people want to know their options, how can they get a hold of Conterra?
Of course, they can go to the web at conterraag.com. I honestly don't know our 800 number off the top of my head.
We'll put your link. We'll put
the link to the website in the description.
Yeah. And we're on the social media thing. I'm not a big social media guy. I do have an Instagram account. I mainly follow woodworkers and farmers on it, but that's the extent of my stuff. But
so Kintara.ag or KintaraAg.com, and then KintaraAg on social media.
Yep,
and we'll have it all linked in the description on YouTube and the audio. But Paul, we appreciate you coming on. I thought it was really valuable. I think it was a really good episode. I think people definitely got some value out of it, and we appreciate you. So that's going to wrap it up, guys. If you got any value from the show, share it out. Leave a review. Go to farmergrade.com if you want some meat. And we'll see you back here next week for another episode.